From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. China expert Yukon Huang says President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping are similar in some ways, but their visions for their countries, America First and Chinese Dream, could lead the two leaders to tension.
They're both nationalists. They're appealing to sentiments in their among their people. They're both appealing to people who feel perhaps they've been left out by the progress that's been occurring in both countries over the last generation.
Huang will discuss the U.S.-China relationship as Trump continues his visit to Asia. But first, Joshua Landis joins us from Italy to provide an update about Syria and the end of ISIS as a territorial state.
It's not finished, but the fact that its territorial state has been destroyed is a big thing.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. Joshua Landis, welcome back to Worldviews all the way from Italy. It's so great to have you here today.
Well, it's great to be with you.
So, Joshua, we haven't had a Syria update since you left us for teaching in Italy. So let's start there. Can you give us an update on what's going on in Syria regarding the conflict?
Well, this is a big week. It's a big week because Bu Kamal, a small town on the end of the Euphrates where the Syrian-Iraqi border is drawn, has just been captured and surrounded by the Syrian army. This is the last major town in which ISIS exists. So this is the end of ISIS, a territorial state. Both the Iraqi army and the Syrian army have met up on the Euphrates River, and they've pushed, they've pancaked ISIS together. So all their fighters have fled. There may be a few little desert sort of crossroad towns that will be mopped up in the coming weeks. But for all intents and purposes, ISIS is no longer a territorial state.
So, Joshua, this is huge news. And so what are we to make of this? I mean, they're not a territorial state. I keep hearing you say they're not a territorial state. But what does that mean? Certainly, ISIS has not been completely eliminated and defeated. So what does this mean?
Well, that's a good question. We're trying to figure out what it means. What role is ISIS going to play in the future? And we just saw in the United States a shooter claimed that he was inspired by ISIS, not a shooter, but this fellow in New York who ran his truck into a bunch of people. And that's what we're expecting. We're expecting more terrorist strikes like that. There are a number of enclaves, both in Egypt, in Libya, and other places in Africa, that where ISIS still has men and can mass to a certain degree. So the United States is pursuing them. But this, it's not finished, but the fact that its territorial state has been destroyed is a big thing, because we recall that it was creating this state that distinguished them from Al-Qaeda, from many other terrorist groups. And it electrified young people who were dissatisfied and angry around the world. And also had a utopian sense that somehow some new Islamic caliphate was going to burst onto the world stage, which it did. And it captured territory almost the size of Great Britain in between Aleppo and Baghdad. And that state, you know, it took 2 years for the United States to really destroy it.
Well, other big news. Let's just add to this the fact that Syria announced this week, the Syrian government announced this week that they were joining the Paris Climate Accord. And I raise this because it was the last country to do so. Nicaragua actually was the only other holdout besides the United States, of course, which is leaving the accord. But Nicaragua joined last month. Syria is joining now. This maybe indicates something about the Syrian government involvement and kind of stepping up and you know, Assad has resumed his role as a regional, maybe a global player on this regard. I mean, I don't mean in terms of power, but the fact that he's joining an international agreement.
Well, 2 weeks ago, there were several news articles about how the only two powers that hadn't signed the agreement were Assad and Trump. And so Assad immediately set about scurrying around to try to sign the agreement as fast as he could. In every other situation, of course, he doesn't look so good.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today all the way from Italy. And we will do another update soon.
Great to be with you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at Worldviews KGOU, and I'm at Suzette Gorlat. Next, China expert Yukon Huang will discuss the evolving relationship between China and the United States. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Yukon Huang is a senior associate in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He focuses on China's economy and its regional and global impact. He spoke with my colleague Rebecca Cruz last week, just before President Trump left on his trip to Asia. Yukon Huang, welcome to Worldviews.
A pleasure to be here.
Well, let's get right to the point. There's been a lot of talk about the United States and the Chinese relationship, particularly in the last year since Donald Trump came to the White House. How do you foresee this relationship? What do you see developing in the last 9 or 10 months, and how do you see it going forward?
Well, the reason why it's important and also tense, of course, is you have a rising power who some people think will be challenging the U.S., which has been the dominant great power for generations now.
Yeah.
And this is creating some tensions. You just had a Party Congress meeting in China a couple weeks ago, which basically confirmed Xi Jinping as a very powerful leader, and he set out a very long-term vision. Here in the U.S., President Trump is soon going to go to Asia. He's going there at a time when there is a lot of debate in the U.S. about priorities, concerns about where the U.S. is going, and many people in America see the future as being affected by China. So these U.S.-China relations is obviously a very important issue for both countries.
Absolutely, and we seem to see it even in the short 9 or 10 months, wax and wane a little bit. The two leaders got together earlier this year in the spring, and they seemed to have a very productive conversation. And then a month or so later, some issues about North Korea and other things. It seems to be going back and forth.
Well, we have an interconnection between economic and political issues. And this is, I think, particular to the China relationship. Because for other countries, it's often just purely a political or international affairs issue. But here is a country whose role globally comes from the fact that economically it's so strong and rising country. So that's unique to China. You also have, from an American perspective, a sense that some of America's problems, whether it's unemployment or growth, is being negatively affected by China, and therefore by China's rise. This creates a tendency to think, well, part of the problem is China. If I can somehow persuade China to pursue its growth policies in a different fashion, that this would be good for America and good for the American people. So this is the source of the tension. And then you have, of course, the security, international issues, North Korea, the sense that China could do more in curbing back North Korea's nuclear ambitions, but they're not doing so. So you have not only the economic concerns, the insecurities generated by that, you also have these security political concerns. Both of them are, of course, very important here to Americans. They are also, very important to the Chinese.
Of course.
And they both sides look at it quite differently. So you have the ripe area for what I call tensions on both sides.
Well, you've given us a sense of some of the fears of the United States, but you mentioned that China looks at this a little bit differently. How is the relationship perceived there?
If you think about China, let's look at the politics of what's going on here. China is now feeling it is now what I call a much richer nation, that it should have an influence commensurate with the fact that it's economically so much stronger than it was be. But in most institutions, in most international agencies, in terms of the global rules of the game, China feels that it doesn't have the authority that it is entitled to. So that's an issue for the Chinese. If you look at North Korea, their perception is that in the region, America's military presence is very strong. So they're in Japan, they're in Australia, they have stations in various countries throughout the region. Their ships are very strong in the whole neighboring waters in the East China Seas. So in some sense, they feel encircled. And this is a difficult issue because from an American perspective, it would be like, well, we like to have freedom of navigation. We're trying to be a calming influence in the region. But if you think about it from a Chinese viewpoint, Suppose there are a lot of Chinese ships floating around Florida, or the Pacific.
Sure.
If you go back a generations ago when the Soviets put missiles on Cuba, from an American perspective, that was non-tenable. But there are actually missiles and things throughout Asia, manned by military or on land. And Chinese basically say, we find this increasingly no longer acceptable. And this is creating a tension. And it basically comes from the fact that China's status, its role in the world, has increased. So it wants a so-called new kind of great power relations. And from an American perspective, they haven't actually recognized that a change in that kind of relationship may be in store.
Well, you've also written that one of the issues may be that President Xi and President Trump actually have some of the same aspirations, have some of the same goals, and that this may prevent them from having a stronger or more profitable or beneficial relationship.
Yeah. The great irony is that when you have two leaders who are similar in some ways, who both are trying to find a vision for their country, that could lead to a clash. From a Chinese perspective, Xi Jinping has laid out this something called a China dream, essentially a greater role for China in the world and in the region. President Trump has laid out this vision of America first. They're both nationalists. They're appealing to sentiments in among their people. They're both appealing to people who feel perhaps they've been left out by the progress that's been occurring in both countries over the last generation. They both see that trying to establish a greater presence suitable for their own domestic audience is very, very important. And then you put this in the context of the fact that U.S.-China relations are being affected by changing power structures, different perceptions about what they should be entitled to and their roles. Then you basically have laid out the foundations for what I call potential concerns and tensions.
So we should expect the relationship between these two presidents to continue on much of the same track that we've seen?
Well, that potential for friction is out there. But both sides also have a very strong incentive to curb this and to try to push this into a more harmonious kind of relationship. Now, why is that? China realizes, for example, that its economic strength comes from trade. Trade across a wide range of countries within the region. Its exports are ultimately destined for Europe and for the United States. That's their major export markets. So for China to flourish or somehow to prosper, it requires what I call harmonious relationships across countries because of these trading relationships. America sees China as a huge potential market.
Sure.
It's not just a competitor in many areas, but it's an area where American skills, particularly in services, could actually play a very important role. America's strength tends to be classified into what I call three areas, agricultural raw materials and energy, and high-value services. So the U.S. is the leader in financial, engineering, legal, educational, the media, entertainment. And all these areas, there's a great market in China. And the Chinese are a bit restrictive in terms of letting foreign investment and high-value services come in. So that particular kind of an issue is actually a potential fruitful area for both sides to get into because both sides could actually benefit. So I would see that the task in the future is trying to moderate the tendencies for friction in these kinds of security-related or these trade conflicts, but to focus more upon beneficial investment relationships between the two countries, which could lead to what the Chinese would call win-win solutions rather than win-lose.
When you mention economics, you've recently published a book called Cracking the China Conundrum, Why Conventional Economic Wisdom is Wrong in Regards to China. What has the West or Western economists, what have they gotten wrong about China and what do we need to know?
Well, let's start off with two general perceptions. You ask practically any American, you even ask policymakers in Washington about trade. And everyone realizes that America has huge trade deficits.
Right.
And a large share of those deficits apparently seem to be due to China because they account for the largest share of that deficit on a bilateral basis. So conventional wisdom would say that America's trade problems are due to China and that if China's surpluses, huge surpluses, could be curtailed, that this would help reduce America's deficit. In my book, I basically point out that there's actually no analytical conceptual relationship between America's trade deficits and China's trade surpluses. America's had a trade deficit every year for 40 straight years, through good times and bad times, when there was full employment, when there was high unemployment, okay? When it was growing rapidly, when it was growing slowly. And for much of those 40 years, China was not even a factor.
Right.
So how could China be responsible for America's deficits when in reality, 10 years ago, for example, it didn't even have any surpluses that mattered, and yet U.S. was having very large trade deficits. At that time, if you go back to the late 90s and early 2000s, America's deficits were showing up as deficits with Japan, mm-hmm. Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, other kinds of Asian countries. Today, it shows up as China, because those countries now don't produce the complete product. They produce the parts and components, which are then shipped to China, assembled in China, and then shipped to America. So that iPhone or iPad that many Americans have, which are produced in China, and they sell, let's say, a phone might sell for $600, $700, only $25 of that actually goes to China. The rest of it goes to Taiwan, Japan, South Korea. Those parts come from those other countries. So it looks like a China issue. It's not actually a China issue at all. It's an Asian issue. But it's not even an Asian issue. It's issue. The basic issue is, as long as Americans consume more than they earn, America will have a trade deficit. So how do you solve this? There's two solutions. Americans need to save more. They live off of debt.
True.
So they haven't been able to save. The second issue is the U.S. budget. When you run a U.S. deficit, a budget deficit, it translates ultimately into a trade deficit. And many people don't associate the two. They think a budget deficit, maybe it should be larger, maybe it should be smaller. But they don't realize that if there is a deficit, it automatically transfers into a trade deficit. And who that deficit is incidental. It doesn't really matter. So that's one issue. And then the other issue is that Americans think that too much of U.S. companies invest too much overseas, and they think that a lot of it is going to China. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that leads to job loss and loss of competitiveness. And so in my book, I point out that if you look at the totality of America's foreign investment overseas, less than 2% of it goes to China. It's almost negligible. So the question is actually quite different. It switches from that too much is going to China to why is there so little, okay? And I basically point out because America's strengths are in agriculture mm-hmm. and there is in commodities or energy. This doesn't lead to foreign investment in a country. You don't grow. America's not going to be farmers in China, or they're not going to become miners in China. So they don't invest a lot. Europeans actually invest a lot because they're a manufacturing country. But where America is strong is services, and services are in fact restricted in China. So this is the area where you could actually liberalize, and there'd be more foreign investment going to China. So the question is actually turned around. Because we began with the assumption that too much was going, and now we come to the real issue. The real issue is that more should be going, but isn't. And if it did go, there'd be more jobs in America, and there'd be more jobs in China. It's a win-win situation.
Well, as you said, it's all about the perception then. It sounds like we need to work to change some of those ideas. Oh, one of the perceptions that I think many have had for the last couple of decades is that China is a global polluter and have hurt the environment in some ways, the smog. But we've seen in the last couple of years that China is actually taking the lead on environmental issues. Can you talk with us a little bit about what this motivation comes from? Is this another means of exerting influence, or where does this come from?
Well, a couple of years ago, the standard view would be China is the problem in terms of pollution, environmental concerns, and climate change, because in terms of total emissions, carbon emissions, China exceeds the United States, just exceeds the United States. So you have the U.S. and China are, in fact, the two world's largest
polluting
nations.
Right, both of them, yes. Okay.
But China is, in terms of population, 1.3 billion people. Four times the size of America, yet its pollution level is about the same. So the average Chinese is in some sense, contributing one quarter as much to the global problem as the average American. And that's understandable because Americans are much richer. so they use much more energy. So China has now basically said this is a problem. So they're very supportive of climate change. They were not supportive 10 years ago because they were still preoccupied with growth. Now they're more concerned about the quality of life. So politically, there's a sea change in China. The average person basically says we should be worrying about environment, we should be worrying about climate change, even if it has some kind of a consequence upon growth and jobs. But the interesting thing is, from a Chinese perspective, they actually do not see environmental issues as damaging commercial business interests.
It's an economic benefit.
Benefit, because then they say we can invest a lot in the technologies. Mm-hmm. We can produce the equipment that can deal with this. We can actually turn this into a growth driver. In the U.S., we tend to think of environment or climate change as a growth inhibitor. So the Chinese think of it as a growth driver. I think the third thing I think is quite interesting is a very large percentage of China's leadership have science degrees. Okay? If you go to the U.S. Congress, very few. It's mostly lawyers. Okay? So for the Chinese, this is actually a scientific issue.
Sure.
And they look at the data and the facts, and the conclusion to them is fairly obvious. There is a problem. But it's easier for the Chinese leadership to absorb this, because for them, with science backgrounds, they tend to have more faith in these kinds of numbers. So you have not only what I call the conceptual issue, the political, the economic, and this is why China today is much more willing to play a leadership role in climate change than, for example, America is today.
Well, this is just fascinating. As you say, we have some preconceived ideas of China, and you've certainly enlightened us today on some new ways of looking at things. So thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to a conversation between my colleague Rebecca Cruz and China expert Yukon Huang. He's a senior associate in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.